So when I was 6 years old, I got sick with fevers and chills. So my mother took me to the doctor. He was a rather very tall, like 6'4", 6'5", thin, stern kind of guy. He looked at me, looked at my mother, and told me that I had influenza. And I burst into hysterical tears, and it took several minutes for my mother to calm me down. The doctor was surprised, and my mother was surprised. When they finally got me calmed down enough and asked me what was wrong, I said, "But that's what Uncle Grady died of." For you see, my maternal grandmother's twin brother died in the influenza outbreak of 1917. I had taken that story in my family history and laid a certain understanding over it, the understanding that influenza is always deadly. The doctor thought he was giving me a simple diagnosis. My mother thought I had the flu and needed some aspirin and a little time in bed. I thought I was dying. It is interesting sometimes to surface our family stories and find out a little bit more about what is and is not part of the reality of that history. Our Statue of Liberty is a symbol of the sanctuary that the United States can be, and it has some history that you may not know. Not all of our family story is told all the time. Frenchman Edward de Laboulaye first proposed the idea of a monument for the United States in 1865. 10 years later, sculptor Frederick Auguste Bartholdi was commissioned to design the sculpture with the 1876 centennial of the signing of the Declaration of Independence in mind. The statue was named Liberty Enlightening the World and was a joint effort between America and France. Bartholdi required the assistance of an engineer to address structural issues associated with designing such a colossal copper structure. And Alexander Gustav Eiffel, designer of the Eiffel Tower, was commissioned to design the massive iron pylon and secondary skeletal framework, which allows the statue's copper skin to move independently and yet stand upright. And this picture is the picture of that internal pylon. Its engineering is stupendous. It is, in essence, designed and built like a ginormous 3D puzzle that also has to withstand the elements. Eiffel designed this internal structure around which the pieces of copper that had been shaped could be attached. That is the inside of the face of Lady Liberty, and you will see that not only is it shaped as a face, but then there's this metal structure that gets attached to other metal structures that gets attached to the internal pylon. It's a little like the bone. There are bones, and then there are metals that are the metal supports that attach the copper pieces to the bones, a little like tendons and sinews. That is the outside of the face. And just for like size comparison, because the size of this statue is almost incomprehensible. This is the statue actually being constructed in France. It was constructed in France to make sure it worked, then disassembled, shipped over in boxes, and reassembled in New York. So it stands from base to torch 151 feet and 1 inch. The pedestal foundation to tip of torch is 305 feet and 1 inch. The length of one of its hands is 16 foot 5 inches. Its index finger is 8 feet long. The length of her sandal is 25 foot, which evidently would be a US woman's shoe size 879. The width of the tablet is about 13 and a half feet, and the length is about 23 and a half feet. The copper is the thickness of 2 pennies. And the whole statue and I believe including the base, but the weight of the statue is 450,000 pounds. But the origins of the Statue of Liberty enlightening the world is not just about our declared independence from England. Even the full name, the Statue of Liberty enlightening the world, is about how the liberty found in America speaks to the world. Laboulaye was an abolitionist, and originally he was inspired by the Union defeating the Confederacy. In an interview with the magazine Vice, Ed Berenson, director of the French Institute at NYU, was asked the question, how did Laboulaye conceive the Statue of Liberty? And his answer was, during his time, Laboulaye was leading the French, was the leading French expert and admirer of the United States. He felt more sympathetic to the American version of liberty than to the French one. And he wasn't blind to slavery, because Laboulaye was also the head of France's Abolition Society. So Laboulaye thought that the victory of the North in the Civil War was a great development because he thought it would abolish slavery once and for all. The tragedy was that the architect of that abolition, Lincoln, had to sacrifice his life. And so when these two things happened, the assassination of Lincoln and the end of the Civil War, Laboulaye came up with the idea of giving the United States a major gift that would commemorate Lincoln and recognize the abolition of slavery. Bartholdi, who had been commissioned to design the statue, used as his starting point a design he had made for an Egyptian statue that never came to be. He shifted it to become a Greco-Roman style, and he added these chains. Those early statues, and he made some early statues like small ones as models, and they still had this original idea of the breaking of slavery because the statues held broken chains in their hands, not underneath their feet. And as those models and sketches evolved, the chains shrunk until all that's left of them is what we see today, which is the chain under the Statue of Liberty's foot. So you get a morphing of the Statue of Liberty from mainly being about the abolition of slavery to now being more generally about American liberty. There is a children's book entitled Her Right Foot. I'm going to read you a rather lengthy excerpt because they said it better than I could. The point is that even if you have seen a picture, The point is that even if you have seen a picture of the Statue of Liberty, or many pictures of the Statue of Liberty, or even hundreds of pictures of the Statue of Liberty, you probably have not seen pictures of her feet. And if you have seen pictures of her feet, you probably have not seen pictures of the back of her feet, particularly her right foot. What would you notice when you see this picture? That's right. She is going somewhere. She is on the move. Let's pause here and collect ourselves and think about this. Let's discuss this. Let's think about and discuss the fact that this is the largest sculpture in the land and the most iconic symbol of the United States of America. Let's talk about the fact that this statue has welcomed millions of visitors and immigrants to the USA. People talk about her unusual headwear. They talk about her gown, which seems a very heavy kind of garment and would likely result in really serious lower back issues. They talk about her beautiful torch or the severe look on her face. But no one talks about the fact that she is walking. The 150-foot woman is on the go. Every time we see the Statue of Liberty in pictures or any time we imagine the Statue of Liberty, we see her standing very still. Like, well, a statue. But she is moving. She weighs 450,000 pounds and wears an 879 shoe, and she is moving. How can we all have missed this? Or even if we saw this and noticed it, how is it that we have seen and noticed a 450,000-pound human on her way to somewhere and said, oh, just another 150-foot woman walking off a 150-foot pedestal? And most important, where is she going? Is she going to Soho to get a panini? Is she going to the West Village to look for a vintage record? No, no, she's facing southwest, so she's facing New Jersey. Could she be going to Trenton? Wait, no. She's facing southeast, so she's not going to New Jersey. But she is going somewhere. Where? Why is she moving? There are certain things we know. We know that around her feet are chains, and they are broken chains, implying that she has freed herself from bondage. We know that Bartholdi wanted us to know this. He wanted us to see the chains. People have talked about the chains, but few people talk about that foot that is so obviously in mid-stride, and the fact that her entire right leg is in mid-stride. What does this mean? What does this mean that we often forget about this right foot, this right leg? Here isn't an idea. Here is a theory. Here is a reminder. If the Statue of Liberty is a symbol of freedom, if the Statue of Liberty has welcomed millions of immigrants to the United States, then how can she stand still? Liberty and freedom from oppression are not things you get or grant by standing around like some kind of statue. No, these are things that require action, courage, and unwillingness to rest. The Statue of Liberty was not built to welcome just 1,886 immigrants from Italy on some certain Sunday in 1886, say. No. She was built to welcome 3,000 immigrants from Poland the next day, and the next day, 5,000 Norwegians, and after that, 10,000 Glaswegians, then Cambodians, then Estonians, Somalis, Nepalese, Syrians, Liberians. It never ends. It cannot end. After all, the Statue of Liberty is an immigrant too, and that's why she's moving. This is why she's striding. In welcoming the poor, the tired, the struggling to breathe free, she is not content to wait. She must meet them in the sea. So what does this Statue of Liberty have to teach us about sanctuary? Liberty and sanctuary are tied together in a very complicated way in this country. Unless you're part of an indigenous people, your people immigrated here, either by the slave trade or by choice. Our country owes its origins to immigration and the idea that we could be a place for folks to escape tyranny. And in fact, in our early years, folks immigrating was really important because we needed all those bodies to steal the land from the people already here. This is part of manifest destiny, right? The paradox is that the idea of liberty was used to attract people to this country in order that they could take the liberty and freedom away from the indigenous people already here. But still in our hearts beats this metaphor of freedom and liberty, something we don't always do well, but that we aspire to and we fail at too. And if you can't see the sign on the statue here, it says, "Refugees welcome." It was hung from the Statue of Liberty during a protest. We have entered a time where this idea of giving sanctuary to those escaping tyranny is dying or dead. Now, our former mayor, Stephanie Miner, declared Syracuse a sanctuary city. And Ben Walsh has upheld that in that the Syracuse police will not arrest somebody simply on an immigration violation or status alone. But it's way more complicated than simply declaring yourself a sanctuary city. Because who determines sanctuary status anyway? It turns out that sanctuary policy is determined at the county level by the sheriff, and it has to do with whether the sheriff will enforce detainer requests from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. And if you think this is a far-off concern, remember that we are within 100 miles of the border of Canada, and so the presence of ICE is strong in Syracuse. When an immigrant is arrested for a crime, he or she is booked and fingerprinted at the county jail. Those fingerprints go to the Federal Bureau of Investigation and in turn to ICE. If ICE finds that a person is here illegally, it sends the jail a detainer request. ICE asks the jail to hold the person while a warrant is prepared for deportation, usually 48 hours. What the jail does next determines sanctuary status, since compliance is voluntary. The jail may disregard the detainer request and release the prisoner once charges are dropped or bail is posted, like it would with anyone else. Or the jail can hold the person until ICE arrives with a warranty and takes custody. The Onondaga County Sheriff has said he would honor detainer requests, even though he's never gotten one. At least that was in a newspaper article a couple of years ago. So technically that means that Syracuse is not a sanctuary based on that community-used criteria. The mayor really has no say in the matter. So even though Mayor Walsh has said that the Syracuse police will not arrest someone based on immigration status, Syracuse is not technically a sanctuary city because our county is not a sanctuary county. The issue of immigration is a hot issue in this country, and people's lives are at stake. All you had to do was read the news this week. Some folks in this congregation have said to me that they think it would be good for us to be involved in the present-day sanctuary movement, whereby churches give sanctuary to people in their building who are trying not to be deported. And it is complicated. Providing sanctuary is, in its ideal, a good thing, and those who provide sanctuary are breaking the law. There is no law in America that says churches or houses of worship are allowed to provide sanctuary. But churches are considered sensitive sites, and ICE has a general policy to not arrest in sensitive sites. And then there is emergency sanctuary, which is really just for a couple of days, or long-term sanctuary. There is making one's church a sanctuary church where people are housed, or you can join the sanctuary movement by supporting a church that is using its building as a sanctuary. It might make sense for this congregation to take some time and seriously consider, do we want to be involved in the sanctuary movement in some way? It's a serious question, but there may come a time when sanctuary is not simply an immigration issue, but is also an LGBTQ issue. This isn't my call to make, thank goodness, because it's too big for one person to make. It is a question that belongs to the congregation. But I do think the question of sanctuary comes directly out of our work of welcoming. If we take seriously what it means to be radically hospitable, the question of whether we should participate in the sanctuary movement is an inevitable question in this political climate. As we deepen our welcome, the question of sanctuary will arise again and again. So let me cite those closing words of Her Right Foot. It never ends. It cannot end. After all, the Statue of Liberty is an immigrant too, and this is why she is moving. This is why she's striding, in welcoming the poor, the tired, the struggling to breathe free. She is not content to wait. She must meet them in the sea. In a world without end, may this be so.